You may proceed.
Very much the same, at least in the appeal of McDougall, Levick versus McDougall. We have appeal on the single issue of void versus voidable, which is one of the things I was arguing, but I can proceed on that if that's where we are in the case. Again, we're asking the court to reverse the appellate court judgment in part. And on the issue of void versus void, the Court of Appeals said, after thorough analysis and consideration, said that what the parties did, solemnization, no license, no solemnization, they said no marriage was ever created. No marriage was contracted in Virginia. No marriage was contracted in Virginia that would entitle Ms. McDougall to any marital property distributions because there was no marriage. She was, that the marriage was, the attempted marriage was not created, and she could not be entitled to post-divorce spousal support. But after saying that and making those specific findings that no marriage was ever created, no rights, marital rights, arose out of this attempted marriage, the court then said that the union was voidable as opposed to void ab initio. And the conundrum and the problem that is created by this is it puts absolute confusion in the law about whether marriages are valid, invalid, and is there now this third class of a marriage.
Let me ask you about that, counsel, because you said earlier that this was a case of first impression about the marriage. Is this also a case of first impression about whether it's void or voidable?
It's the first case about void or voidable as it relates to the court saying it's voidable until is declared void, and then the voidness is retroactive. So the Court of Appeals, it seems to me, clearly was saying what they attempted to create was a nullity, but rather than declaring it void ab initio, meaning void from its inception, just a nullity, the court said, whether it's void or voidable, it really doesn't matter because once we declare it void, it's void retrospectively.
Let me. Here's what I want to ask you.
There's no other case that we found.
Thank you. Here's what I want to ask you about. It seems like this is a 10-year marriage. At least for 10 years, the parties thought they were married, approximately. Which result is going to cause the less mischief? If we declare it to be void ab initio and go back, or we declare it void at this point in time, there's going to be mischief no matter what way we do it. Which is the worst or best way to handle it?
Yes, I really think the only mischief is going to occur if we call it a voidable marriage. Because a voidable marriage, marriages are usually, but not always, usually treated as valid until they are declared void. So if we've got a union that didn't create anything, that didn't they didn't contract a marriage, they didn't get obtain any legal rights, but we're saying it's voidable, I think that's where the confusion comes.
Well, don't we get back to Justice Mims' question about third parties who have, in reliance upon a marriage certificate, have gone ahead and made agreements based upon tenants by the entirety, for example, which now you're saying no longer exists.
Well, what I'm, what I
In other words, there's going to be a problem no matter what we do. So I'm asking, which is the best way to do this?
I don't think there would be a problem. I don't agree with that.
Okay.
Because the marriage laws are simple. And people have followed them. Everybody knows, I think, you get a license, you solemnize. This issue has not been a floodgate in Virginia of people doing it the opposite way and thinking they were creating a marriage. I think what this case needs is clarity. I think everything that the Court of Appeals found in this case is absolutely accurate until you get to that one part of the
So what would happen if a creditor of one of the two spouses put a lien on a tenancy by the entirety of property? Would the creditor under the void ab initio doctrine be able to come into court where the two parties want to remain married, thought they were married, hear this grand legal theory that they haven't been married for the first time? Would the creditor be able to make the argument that the rabbi signed the document too late and thus they can attach the separate interest of the spouse because tenancy by the entirety doesn't protect the property? Because void ab initio things can be challenged by anybody in any proceeding at any time. It's a bit of an overstatement, but it's
right.
Often true.
Right.
So going back to the mischief question, that's a lot of mischief to me, particularly if the parties want to remain married and are stunned by the assertion of the judges that they're not.
Well, Oldfield said it in 1902 that the injury may be harsh in some situations, but that the greater good is served by adherence to the mandatory statutory
Oldfield
requirements.
Was a common law marriage holding. The point was orbs away from what we're talking about now. We're parsing timing ever so slightly. And your earlier remark left an impression upon me. You said that both of these issues are arguably cases of first impression. No one has dead-on-point cases on either side. Convince me, to the extent you can, that when you're in that kind of equipoise, you search for broader principles. You don't get nano about things or microscopic about legal principle. You look for broader principles. And the broadest principle here is there's a presumption of the validity of marriage. It goes back to antiquity. And if there's any doubtful case, and if there's reasonable doubt as to the validity of the marriage, you presume it to be. That's a tiebreaker principle. Why isn't that applicable to both the avoidable question and to your initial validity question?
Because the presumption is rebuttable. If you have clear, cogent, convincing evidence, it's a rebuttable presumption. And that's what occurred in this case, because this is what we believe is one of the rare instances where no solemnization ever occurred after obtaining a license. The Court of Appeals said at the Joint Appendix 1872 in a footnote that unlike the trial court, we conclude that the party's marriage was voidable rather than void ab initio. This difference in reasoning may affect future cases involving a similar defect in the formation of marriage, but it does not affect the practical terms or outcome of this case, in the Levick and McDougall case. But the foreshadowing that the reasoning here, and I think that reasoning goes to the void and voidable, is what will create similar defects in the formation of marriage. And sure, we're going back to Oldfield, because this statute, mandatory, not directory. So maybe it looks like we're going back too far, but the law hasn't changed with the various enactments to the marriage creation statute. It has remained constant for over 100 years that marriage, you have a lawful marriage in Virginia, you have a license, and you have a solemnization. If we say that, well, you kind of don't have to do that, or you state that substantially complied, so now maybe it's voidable. You're leaving a window open where someone's going to do what? Think that there was validity of this union when no union was ever created. I think the greater good is going to come by this court making absolutely clear that the marriage laws in Virginia are mandatory, and if you do not follow them, it's just two things you need to do. Get a license first, then solemnize, then you don't create a legal union. I don't think that's going to open the floodgates for people getting it wrong or for creditors. I think the statute 2031.1 gives this court authority even to take a union under Chapter 2 that doesn't come into existence, that's a nullity, and to actually deem it null and void. 2031.1 is the statute that legitimizes children of an illicit cohabitation. And it lists three kinds of unions for which these children would be legitimized. One is prohibited unions, bigamy, sanguinity, marriages that are dissolved by the court, referring to voidable marriages, but it says unions that are deemed null and void. And we believe that that affirmatively gives the court some guidance that the legislature thought that there might be times that this court would have to evaluate a union that would be null, and it gives it the authority to do so. The court's reliance on in the case of Beveling versus Beveling and Kistler versus Kistler, the two West Virginia cases, one from the 1800s and Kistler being 55 years later, that state has marriage licensing requirements very similar to our 20.13 and our 20.31, the curative statute. And that court has looked at the issue of whether a union that isn't in compliance with 2013 license then solemnization, whether it is void or voidable. And the court determined that the fact that there's a curative statute that says as long as you've solemnized under license, if you've got these minor defects, your union will still be valid, facially apparent that it's valid, and that curative statute is almost an express declaration that if your union doesn't comply with license first, then solemnization, and if it's not then cured by the curative statute, that it is a void marriage.
Well, let me ask you this, though, counsel. Then in 20-43, the General Assembly picked out one kind of void marriage, bigamous marriages, and said, this one's void ab initio. Why didn't they say that about marriages when you have the license or you have a ceremony without a license?
That statute, as well as 2045 and 2038 that talk about prohibited marriages, refer to marriages that have been solemnized under license. When you look at the difference between Chapter 2 and Chapter 3 of Title 20, if you don't create a union despite the requisite mandatory requirements that you get a license and then you solemnize, you don't create anything that's going to be evaluated under Chapter 3. And I think the reason that that's not listed as a void marriage is because it doesn't get to that side of the table, because it doesn't have.
But it seems like to a third party it would be the same problem. A third party would see a marriage certificate for a bigamous marriage, and he'd see a marriage certificate for this marriage. So it would be the same problem, wouldn't it? The same
right.
Same problem with mischief. In other words, a third party creditor, when he makes sure that the parties were married, would find a marriage license for the bigamous couple, just like he'd find a marriage license for the couple in this case.
Well, I mean, and that's why I think it's so important that it be declared a void union, void ab initio, so that it is subject to regulation by the Commonwealth, but also it can be attacked collaterally or directly at any time, any court, for any reason. So that if the union is not created, if it ends and results in a common law marriage, which is what, in fact, this union would be if the court determines.
Thank you. You've answered my question. Thank you.
Thank you. Your time has expired. Mr. Cottrell?
And please, the court. There is one lens through which this analysis should be conducted in reviewing the statutes, and that is Virginia's strong public policy of upholding marriages whenever possible. This is not a hunt for a way to defeat the marriage. This is instead a search for a way to uphold the marriage. In doing that, we have to look at statutes like 20-13 and see what they expressly prohibit and what it is they allow, because they don't prohibit it. Now, in this particular instance, as we've already discussed in the prior appeal, the parties, along with the officiant, decided on a process. They decided when that process would begin, and they decided when the process would end. The officiant was satisfied of his primary duty, the intent of the parties to be married. That's his function, to be able to be satisfied with that. The two attorney general's opinions that we have submitted and referred to in our briefs both deal with deferrals to the officiant as to whether he was satisfied as to the identity of the parties and their intent to be married. Again, hearkening back to the idea that this is a private contract between the parties, that the statute wants to be witnessed so it can be made part of the marriage register. And that gets us to the question that has been raised first by Justice Mims, I think it's been reiterated by Justice Kelsey, and also by Justice Millett, and that is, what kind of mischief is going to result if this marriage is set aside? And the mischief to the third party should be obvious. Everybody who depends on the marriage register, or may have depended on the marriage register, is going to have that dependence thwarted because the marriage register will no longer be reliable. The second thing is that there will be great mischief done to the rights of Ms. McDougal. Let's not forget about it here. And this is why the agreement is so important. The agreement between the parties is actually a way of quantifying what Ms. McDougal was entitled to out of the marriage, not by some court, but by the parties themselves. And it amounted to a substantial sum of money. They didn't enter into an agreement that said, you gave as good as I got, we both walk away from this with nothing. No. The agreement between the parties was she was to walk away with substantially more because of her contributions to this marriage. And that agreement has been defeated by Mr. Levick's ability to come in and challenge the status of his marriage so that he could then reopen an argument for rescission with respect to the agreement. Now, the motive is no higher than that. Now, when you weigh that against the public policy in favor of upholding marriages, and we look at 20-13 and we see there's no prohibition to a solemnization agreed by the parties of the nature of which I've described, then it seems to me that 20-13 has been completely satisfied in this case. And that is the simplest explanation and the simplest way in which the expectations, the just expectations of everyone, third parties, and these parties to the marriage, where the evidence was uncontested that they always intended to be married and everything they did was in an effort to be married, would be realized. And it does no violence whatsoever to any public policy here in the Commonwealth of Virginia. In fact, it fulfills the public policy of upholding marriages whenever possible. Now, let me address for a moment this idea of void versus void. I think there's two points to be raised here. Assuming for the sake of argument that this kind of technicality could result in a characterization of the marriage as void, we would say the following. First, the Court of Appeals, with no citation to any authority whatsoever, said that once it's determined to be voidable, then it's retrospective to the time of the defect. Now, if that were the general rule, you would think it would be shown in Virginia case law. We haven't been able to apply any case law on that point, but we do have three cases that do the contrary. Marbleax, Commonwealth versus Payne, and McConkie. In every one of those cases, the voidness of the marriage became effective at the time that the court declared it, and it was not retrospective back to the time of the defect. So if we have any tradition in our jurisprudence, it's not to make it retrospective. And if ever there was a case when it should not be made retrospective, it is this case. Because Levick has had the benefit of a wife for this entire time. And we know from the agreement that he comes out of the marriage with all the benefits of having had a wife, but she comes out of the marriage not even with the agreed benefits of what she deserved for being his wife. Now that is a manifest injustice. Now there are numerous times when this court has looked to the equities and their impact on law, setting the policy. McConkie is a good example of that. Now Miss McConkie discovered that her marriage was voidable. She pursued it in court. She obtained a determination that it was void because it was voidable. But the court refused to make it retrospective without consequence, as if it had never happened. And in so doing, the court observed, well, you know, her former husband, it would be unfair to him because he was paying her spousal support and he was entitled to rely on the idea that she had gotten remarried. If the court had made it retrospective to the time of the defect, then the husband would have had to continue to obtain the spousal support. But they didn't do it in McConkie. And the reason they didn't do it was because the equities were present. Here the equities are intersect between these parties. It is whether or not this agreement is going to get set aside because Mr. Levy contends that he didn't know his status. Now that's another element. Mr. Levick, because this would be at most voidable, and certainly not void ab initio, there is no statute that declares it void ab initio, Mr. Levick only knew, if he knew anything, the only thing that he didn't know was his ability to mount a legal challenge to change his status. But at the time that he entered into the agreement and he did everything else, he was married in the eyes of the law. He was married under circumstances where only one of the parties would have standing to challenge that status. And now he wants to escape it. And that's the whole point of trying to make it either retroactive to the point of the defect or else make it void ab initio so that he can escape the agreement. Now, if there were no way which we, in good conscience, could look at the facts of this case and uphold this marriage on one of these bases, that would be different. But I would submit, and I think it's consistent with many sections of Bishop, which has been cited in both the Court of Appeals opinions and in others with favor, particularly sections 423 to 436, 437 to 441, and the form of marriage ceremonies, and the requirements of marriage and statutes and how they develop, I think it's consistent that the first and foremost thing that has to be given effect is the intent of the parties consistent with the purpose of the regulatory statute.
Yeah, counsel, yes. We obviously have to look at the intent of the parties.
Yes.
First, we have to look at the intent of the legislature.
I agree.
And
I'm sorry.
And in 20-31, it begins, no marriage solemnized under a license. In that sentence, the term under is a preposition.
Yes.
What do you suggest the word under means?
I think it means you have to have a license as part of the process.
Okay, so the fact that it says, so I'm looking now at Webster's, which says subject to the authority of as the meaning, as one of the meanings of the preposition under. Do you not, do you agree with that?
Well, I think, yeah, I agree with this much. I agree in two ways. First, I agree that it's subject to authority, but the parties are placed under the authority of the law. There's no question about that. But the second aspect is that we have to recognize that 2031 is a remedial statute.
I understand.
And under the and under some of the cases that we've cited, and under the general rule, that remedial statute is not dissected minutely just for the meaning of each word in it, but also in accordance with the spirit of its remedial
function. Counsel, you are quite an advocate. I'd like to get back to my question.
Of course.
It is a remedial statute, but it is part of a grouping of statutes that I think together allow us to hopefully glean the intent of the legislature. And that's why I'm asking this question. So I'm going to take the Webster's definition. Instead of saying no marriage solemnized under a license issued in this commonwealth, I'm going to say no marriage solemnized by the authority of a license issued in this commonwealth. And as I parse that sentence, I see that the authority, the solemnization requires an authority. And the term issued is in the past tense. Now, that would seem, if I am looking for the intent of the legislature, there's clearly a disagreement. That's why we have very capable counsel on both sides. But would it not seem, would I not be reasonable to conclude that the way this is worded indicates that the license grants the authority, which then leads to the solemnization? I know that's directly contrary to your position, so I want to hear why I'm wrong in making that statement.
I think you're wrong because it's not a certificate for solemnization. It's a certificate to get married. I mean, that's as plain as what the law is. And there is a differentiation, even in Oldfield, between the license and the solemnization. Oldfield emphasizes a license.
Indeed, but it would appear that the license is required for the solemnization based upon the way this sentence is worded.
Well, may I respect that and have something else for you to consider since it is a constellation of statutes. Remember, this is not a license for the officiant to marry. This is not a license for the officiant to marry. This is a license for the parties.
It appears to be both. I'm going to continue with that sentence, and it says, by any person professing to be authorized to solemnize the same. If the authority comes from the license, does not the authority spring to the officiant and the parties together?
The officiant has his own grant of authority in the statutory scheme in terms of what the officiant can do, and his role within the statutory scheme is to be able to bear witness to the private contract of marriage between the parties, so he's in a position to fill out the marriage license and return it to the clerk so that it can be placed in the marriage register. That's his function.
That's not how I read it. That's simple as that. That's why, again, that's why we have courts of law.
Well, I would also ask the court to consider the remedial nature of the statute, and if there is any other reading that might be given to it, would that be a reading, such as Your Honor has made, that defeats the marriage, or is there another reading that could be given to it that would uphold the marriage in accordance with the larger and strongest legal policy that we have?
It is indeed remedial, and there is a long list of reasons, of occurrences, which allow the remediation. I don't see one of them being you didn't actually have a license.
Well,
but again, that's not a question.
No, I understand it. But I mean, but remember, as we construed, as we've explained under 20-13, this was a process that both predated and post-stated the license. By the time that the license had been received by the officiant, he knew, just as with the starter's gun, that this meant that the parties had retained the intent to be married that he had earlier witnessed in a ceremony and a solemnization process that they
counsel
put together.
Let me ask a question, if you've answered Justice
yes.
Lim's question, coupling what he just asked with 20-14.1.
Mm-hmm.
Every marriage license issued under 2014 shall constitute authority for a period of only 60 days from the date of issuance for the solemnization of a marriage.
Yes.
Wouldn't that indicate the license that's issued remains effective for 60 days, and within the 60 days from the date of issuance, the ceremony has to take place?
It doesn't, it doesn't prohibit the solemnization from starting earlier, so long
from
as the
date of issuance.
So that's how long the license is good for, 60 days. And by the way, this all occurred within that 60 days.
How about from the date of issuance for the solemnization of the marriage of the licensees? From the date of issuance for the solemnization.
Well, the solemnization was not completed until the license was returned. That is the way the parties did it. And remember, we do have two decisions from this court that says that the state has no interest in the form of solemnization.
So your point is signing the license was the agreed upon last act of solemnization.
That's correct.
And it happened simultaneously.
That's correct. So that would be our position with respect to those matters. I have nothing further.
Your time is expired. The court will be at recess until 11:30.
All rise.